For National Public Radio, this is Josh Darsis speaking to you from the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. In a moment, the fifth of this spring's series of national town meetings will be getting underway. The topic of this town meeting, the independent vote. Is it killing the two-party system? The principal speakers will be historian Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., pollster Lewis Harris, and Richard Obenshain, co-chairman of the Republican National Committee. Following the initial presentations, members of the audience will have the opportunity to present questions to the speakers. These national town meetings are aimed at presenting distinguished figures from various walks of life, discussing with you, our radio audience, and with the audience assembled here at Kennedy Center, some of the most important issues of the day. And now, the moderator of today's national town meeting, a syndicated columnist, Robert Novak.
Our first speaker of the three is Professor Arthur Schlesinger of the City University of New York. Professor Schlesinger has won Pulitzer Prizes writing about politicians and even tried politics for a while himself as a member of the Kennedy White House staff. Most recently, he decided that the presidency was a little too strong, particularly when Richard Nixon was president, in a new book, The Imperial Presidency. Professor Schlesinger.
Thank you. Our question today, I take it, is the independent voter killing the two-party system? Well, no one can doubt that the two-party system is in grave trouble, and no one can doubt the rise of independent voting. But I think the rise of independent voting is the consequence rather than the cause of the crisis of the party system. The real question, it seems to me, is why is the party system in this trouble? Why have party loyalties become so weak, party affiliations so fluid, party organizations so irrelevant? The answer to this lies, I imagine, in various long-running social changes, which may perhaps be summed up by saying that the parties have simply lost many of their historical functions. The waning of immigration, for example, has deprived the big city organization of its classical clientele. The spread of civil service has reduced the patronage at the disposal of the political machine. The welfare state has taken over the machine's social welfare role. Above all, I think the electronic revolution has drastically altered the character of the political environment. Two electronic devices in particular have had an especially devastating effect on the traditional structure of politics, television, and the computer. That traditional structure had three tiers: the politician at one end and the voter at the other, and in between a cluster of intermediate agencies, of which the party was foremost, along with the trade union, the ethnic brotherhood, the farm organization, the chamber of commerce. Intermediate agencies mediating between the politician and the voter, interpreting each to the other and providing the links that held the structure together. The electronic revolution has changed all that. Today, television presents the politician directly to the voter. The computerized public opinion poll presents the voter directly to the politician. The mediating agencies, most of all the political party itself, is left to wither on the vine. That is why we see the rise of the independent vote. The parties don't have the general functions today they had a century ago, even 50 years ago. Hence, they no longer command voter loyalty as they once did. Yet they still retain one vital function, and that is the nomination of candidates. But even here they are failing. 1976 will be a great test of the capacity of the parties to survive. If the parties can't produce able and attractive candidates, the voter is going to turn to candidates who bypass the party system who skip over primaries, conventions, and so on, and simply set up their own personal movements. The day we elect as President of the United States a man who has thus bypassed the party system, that system as we have known it will be irreparably changed. If this is so, the future of the parties is clearly not hopeful. It is hard to recall a less inspiring collection of men seeking the nominations in both parties than the contenders today. Is choosing among this band of lusterless figures really the best way we can find to celebrate the bicentennial of American independence? Yet if the parties can't do better for us than this in 1976, then their prognosis is poor. If they cannot discharge responsibly the last great function remaining to them, the presentation of good candidates to the electorate, then we are going to get either new parties or a new politics. Thank you.
From the other side of the political spectrum, we have Mr. Richard Obenshain, who is the deputy chairman of the Republican National Committee and is in custody today of what has been known as, has been called by one Republican senator, a dodo, the Republican Party. Mr. Obenshain, unlike many other Republicans, however, has had some experience with winning and as state chairman in Virginia, managed the successful campaign of Republican candidates for Senate and governor. Mr. Obenshain.
Thank you for building me up there, Mr. Novak. It's a pleasure to be like you in the company of three such distinguished Americans, and for a country boy like myself, I can revel in it. My answer to the question is that, no, the independent voter is not killing the party system by any means. It is strengthening it in America today. The polls, like those of our distinguished panelist, Mr. Harris, show a great increase in the independent voter. But I think it's important to recognize that that is the independent voter, either on the other end of the telephone or behind that door, that individual who is answering the question about his individual preference of party. And more he's bypassing a direct response to, is he a Republican or a Democrat, and responding that he is an independent. But distinguish between that individual answering the poll and Americans going, as Dr. Schlesinger says, to bypassing the political system and going in a group outside the political parties and into an independent political movement itself. In that area, it is encouraging to note that the independent as a group has far less impact on American politics today than it has had in many other periods of our history. During the 1880s and into the early 1900s, and again from 1912 to 1952, there were a substantial number of independents elected as independents to the United States Congress and the United States Senate. But since 1952, it has been a great rarity for someone to go outside the political system itself, outside the two parties, and be elected as an independent to either the presidency or to either of the houses of Congress. What is happening if you focus on those individual voters who are saying, no, I'm not a Republican, I'm not a Democrat, I am an independent, is that what we have is a less dogmatic tie to the parties in this country. I think that's good. I know of areas in my home state of Virginia, and each of you know some areas, I'm sure, in your own, where politics is a grim and deadly business. People are either, by George, Republicans or they are Democrats. And it takes a major uproar of one type or another to sway that 50% from the one side or 50% to the other to ever deviate from their lifelong commitment to one party or the other. Well, that has been changed. There is a more objective attitude on behalf of the voters. More of them are standing back saying, show me. Okay, Democrats, okay, Republicans, we're going to make the decisions in this election. Now, you show us. We're not committed to either of you. We're going to take the choice between the best candidates and the best policies that are offered to us. I think the best system in this country would be if we could get both of the parties to roughly give or take, say 30% each, 30% Democrats and 30% Republicans, and probably about 40% of the folks as independents, these folks who are standing back and making objective judgments on the products, the issues, and the candidates that are presented to them by both parties. I think we've made a substantial step in the right direction. I close these initial remarks with just an aside that far from killing the Republican Party, the independent vote has really, in one sense, kept us alive for a long, long time. I note, and you will remember, that in every presidential election in this country since 1952, with one exception, 1964, in every election but one, a majority of the independent voters have voted for the Republican Party. So bless their hearts, we love the independent voters. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Obenchain. Our third speaker will try to give you a idea of what the voter really thinks about these matters, the independent voter and the other voters. He is one of the foremost pollsters in the United States, Mr. Lewis Harris. Mr. Harris.
It's our business to try to measure what are the trends in politics in this country, and most of all, to not represent the best of prevailing wisdom along the banks of the Potomac, but rather what's happening in the minds, the lives, the behavior of the people of the United States from one end of this land to the other. And I can tell you that the political map of America has been torn up beyond recognition. The old politics are finished. We will never see politics again as they've been in this country. I state that categorically. I'll give you some substance to support that. Back in 1968, many light years ago in terms of events, but not very many years ago as the clock ticks, we had 50% Democrats in this country, people who called themselves Democrats, 32% Republicans, and 18% who called themselves independents. What is it today, as of 2 weeks ago? The Democrats had slipped to 44%. The Republicans slipped disastrously from 32 to 18%. And independents have more than doubled from 18 to 38%. And yet, as we explore this, as we look into it, probe into it, it is far less a commitment on the part of people to independence in politics than it is an almost total non-commitment to the existing political parties. And as George Orwell said, to paraphrase his words, in this disenchantment with the political parties, by far, the Republican Party has been more equal. As a consequence, the Republican Party has suffered more relatively than the Democratic Party. And yet, having said that, I suppose the only force in this land that's capable of saving the Republican chances in the 1976 election will be none other than the Democratic Party itself. The fact of the matter is that I think I agree with Arthur Schlesinger that independence in politics, as it's stated by the voters these days, is far more not just an early warning, perhaps a very late warning, to the parties, either change or perish, either get with it in terms of where the people are, or you'll be out of existence. New parties will take their place, or if not new parties, we'll throw out the people at the helm of the present parties. We've never lived, I think, and that's a pretty categorical statement for me to say, but I suspect we've never lived in a time when the gaps have rarely been wider between our citizens and their leaders, between those who govern and those who are governed, between those who produce products and those who consume them, between those who are being taught and those who are teaching, between those who run politics and those who participate or don't participate in politics. These gaps, are as real as they're wide, have led to an enormous decay and decline in confidence in the people running the institutions of this country. I'll just tick off a few that have taken place in the last decade. Doctors, who most people think have the power of life and death over them personally, have been sacred cows in our society, down from 72%, who had a great deal of confidence in doctors 10 years ago, down to 47% today. Educators, leaders of higher education, down from 61 to 33%. The military, down from 63 to 25%. Businessmen, down precipitously, 55 to 15%. The clergy, not very high to begin with, down from 45 to 31%. The media, television news, which rose from 22 to 34% in 1973, now back down to 27%. The press, which rose from 22 to 28%, a great deal of confidence because of Watergate, now back down to 21%. Politicians, down from 43 to 12%. Congress, down from 43 to 14%. The executive branch of government, down from 42 to 12%. The heart of the trouble, as I see it from the ongoing studies we make, is that the cause of this gap can essentially be found in an ongoing, consistent, and in my judgment, tragic misreading of our people's hopes and aspirations under the impact of the tragedies of Vietnam and Watergate and the current economic pinch of inflation and the recession. Emerging from our surveys is a deep and abiding sense that among the public that to survive, we must find a community of interest where the common good is given a clear priority over each and every separate interest. Our people are no longer interested in more quantity of anything. Rather, they want more quality of what they already have. Quality is what politics, what life is all about today. People do not think they can beat inflation or the recession individually. They know we are energy short as a country, and people are willing to drive their cars slower, heat their homes less, make sacrifices on air conditioning and a whole series of energy measures. And sadly, it's hard to find a politician around who has the guts to ask people, will you please sacrifice for the common good? People know we're rich in food and are willing to set a food-sharing example to the rest of the world beyond, I think, the imagination of anyone who dared measure it. We're willing to give up meat once a week, a majority of people are. We're willing to do away with the use of fertilizers on our front lawns. These are not small majorities. 68-73% of the public favor such things. Today, the people are not always right. I'd be the first to say it, and I could cite many examples. But above all, the people today are way ahead of their leaders and most ahead of the politicians. The people are grown up, serious, sophisticated. They do not, as one president said, have a 12-year-old mentality. They're well beyond that. They're fed up with the cant and rhetoric of politicians who try to corral their votes either by trying to scare them out of their wits with bogeyman stories which say, no matter how badly off you are today, if my opponent's elected, we'll be worse off. You'll be worse off. People don't buy that. They don't buy it. They know that a candidate for president who runs by calling his opponent soft on communism is likely to sit down with the Russians and make peace with them and try to work out problems with them. They know that the politician who makes the easy promise will probably end up not delivering the promise, but if he does, it won't be worth it because people will have to pay in taxes four or five times over what they receive. Basically, what we have is an enormous, just enormous gulf between the hopes and aspirations of the people, which as I read it, are for community of interest, commonality of saying, look, let's attack our common problems instead of attacking each other for a change. And what people are saying as well is that their leaders, as they look at them, have spent 20 years clawing their way to the top. And once they once attain that utmost rung, as Shakespeare said, lo and behold, they're 20 years out of date. That's what's wrong with politics. That's what's wrong with the two-party system. The Democrats have the luck of the draw of being the out party. The Republicans, as the in party, catch a lot of it. But I would say both parties had better look to their last, because it won't simply be independents that's growing apace. It'll be a public who will take the bit and form new politics. 95% of our people want this system to continue. They want it on a survival basis. But make no mistake about it, the leadership is sadly, sadly out of date and in deep, deep trouble. Thank you.
Now it is the audience's turn to question our speakers. Now, these meetings emphasize questions, and not speeches from members of the audience, for we have come to hear our distinguished participants. There are four mics available on the far right and on the far left aisles. Anyone preferring to write his inquiry and have it asked on his behalf should give the cards to the ushers with a question on it, and I'll try to get at the most interesting of these, along with recognizing those waiting to ask questions from the floor. Now, the first question is addressed to Mr. Obenchain from Mary Korinsky of North Grosvenordale, I hope that's pronounced right, Connecticut. And her question, Mr. Obenchain, is Ronald Reagan as much of a threat to the Republicans as Wallace is to the Democrats?
No, I don't think so by any means. To start at the last part first, I think there is a strong possibility that Governor Wallace may be, after he finishes with the Democrats, a threat to both parties, in that if the type of turmoil which seems likely to develop in the Democratic convention and possibly afterwards if Governor Wallace is not pleased with the outcome, given his substantial popularity, I think that will be a very real factor to the general election in 1976. So far as Governor Reagan, it's by no means known at this time whether Governor Reagan will be a candidate for the presidency in 1976. If he is, however, it's my firm expectation that he would be a candidate for the nomination of the Republican Party and not as an independent candidate. And therefore, I think any aspirations he might have would be within the party system, and therefore he would submit, I believe, to the decision of the Republican Convention in 1976. And therefore, I don't think that would be a threat either to the Republican Party or to the two-party system.
Next question is to Mr. Harris, and it's an anonymous question. Will a substantial number of independent voters vote for a third or fourth party? And let me just, since the questioner didn't put his name down, I can mess around with his question. Let me just say that the third party is a Wallace party, and the fourth party is a left party, say, with Eugene McCarthy.
The fact is, it follows up, I think, on the first question. We have real possibilities, because of this sense of disenchantment that people feel over politics, of having the most substantial third or even combined third and fourth party votes in this country in 1976 than I think we've had in many, many years. Our polls, for example, when we run Governor Reagan on the third party conservative ticket, put him at 21%, which is the highest that Governor Wallace ever recorded in our polls since 1968, in September of that year. He later faded as Hubert Humphrey took out after him, down to 13.5% in the vote. But It's my judgment, based on these studies, that you could get as much as 40% of the vote between a conservative third party and a liberal or left, or call it what you will, fourth party. The irony of this is that you take the case of Governor Reagan or Governor Wallace, you get exactly the same phenomenon. You can get a Reagan receiving 21% as a third-party conservative candidate, but you pair Reagan against Senator Kennedy or against Senator Jackson, against Senator Muskie, variety of Democrats, and what do you find? He loses by at least 8 points minimally and as much as 16 points maximally. He does not look like a viable candidate as the Republican nominee for president. You do the same thing with Governor Wallace, the results are even more disastrous. On a third-party ticket, he can receive as much as 19% of the vote. You make him the Democratic candidate against President Ford, and what happens? He loses 61-29%. The fact is, you do the same thing with former Senator McCarthy. You find he can get 18% on a third-party ticket or a fourth-party ticket. You run him against President Ford, and you find he loses by about 18 points. The fact of the matter is, we have potential candidates who, whether or not they wanted to do this, can become spoilers of the political process. They can siphon off enough votes, a minority protest vote, to be able to perhaps throw the election into the House of Representatives. And yet, none of them that have surfaced up to now are viable in their own right as mainstream major party candidates.
Questioner on my right.
My name is Vincent Curtin. I'm from Bethesda, Maryland. And the question is there a good possibility of a coalition-type ruling party in Congress in the near future?
Who are you addressing the question to?
To any of the speakers.
Professor Schlesinger?
Is there a real possibility of a coalition between the Republican governing, between the Republicans and the Democrats in Congress? I would doubt it very much, because though Congress, the two parties in Congress may unite on certain institutional issues, that is, issues which defend Congress as an institution, defend its role in government as an institution, such as the recent bill was passed last year, the Budget and Impoundment Control Act. But nonetheless, the issues which divide the parties on foreign affairs and domestic affairs seem to me substantial enough as to prevent a coalition of the parties in Congress. I would hope that this would be the case, because if there were no difference between our parties, then our party system is dead anyway. And one of the great points of having a party system is to have debate and discussion between the parties, so that the people will understand what the issues are and we will be able to have a role in deciding them.
I have another question for Professor Schlesinger from Barbara Kozak of Schenectady, New York. She says, I have read the reason for weaknesses in the major parties being able to keep their voters in line is that they have failed to keep up with social change. What's your opinion of that?
Well, as I said in my remarks, I do think that changes of various sorts, mostly beyond the control of the parties, have deprived the parties of most of their historical functions. If it is argued as my eminent colleague on my left, I speak geographically from the perspective of the platform, as the Republican National Committee has recently been involved in an attempt, presumably, to adapt to social change by having contemplating a high-pressure advertising campaign on television. That seems to me a very superficial form of adaptation. I think it will only demean a political party if they were to make a big effort of this. And I must say, my colleague tells me that they have decided not to do so. I do think that the question of adapting to social change means not just thinking about images. Images are the consequence of of what you are and what you do, no amount of Madison Avenue magic is going to persuade the public that a party or a candidate is different from what they are. And it's what a party stands for that's going to create the image, and this cannot be altered by any amount of adaptation to the new media. So I would say that the question in that regard, the question is, as it has always been, parties are going to rise and fall on what they stand for and on the candidates that they put forward. And I think the major test that the party system faces for 1976 is, as I suggested earlier, putting good candidates forward, particularly in a presidential election. And thus far, they both seem to me to be failing that test.
Mr. Harris wants to intercede.
Just one quick interjection, Arthur, that I must say I share your views about image making. I think if the public is really turned off and skeptical of anything, it's this quote, efforts on the part of any part of the establishment to improve its image with some sort of contrivance. What I didn't tick off in that sad roster of decline of confidence in institutions was the one that sat right on the bottom. It's those who run advertising in the country. Only 7% have a great deal of confidence in them. So I say to the politicians, caveat emptor when you begin to take paid advertising to prove your case.
As has been his lot in life, the Republican on the panel, Mr. Obenshain, is getting battered from either side, so he has an opportunity for a brief rebuttal.
Number one, it was or is not to be a slick Madison Avenue advertising campaign. Number two, it hasn't been entirely abandoned, Professor. But the point of the matter is that Mr. Harris and his distinguished colleagues have found some very bad and, in our opinion, totally erroneous opinions among the American people about the Republican Party. You can all recite them, the party of big business, et cetera, whereas the Democrats are widely regarded to be the party that with concern for the people, et cetera. My answer to that question is that rather than what Mr. Harris suggests, that the critical need is to ask individuals to sacrifice for the public good, which we all agree every American is willing to do so, that we feel a need to go to this great independent majority of the country and express to them what is becoming increasingly apparent, and that is that it's the swollen size and level of expenditure and deficit spending, et cetera, of the federal government, which is more responsible for this malaise and this ill of our country than any of these other matters. And I think that's what the independent voter in this country is most anxious to hear, is a little bit of plain truth about the excessive role that the federal government has taken in the life of this country and the very unpleasant results we're now suffering as a result of that.
May I, Bob? I would like to say that on this question, I think the only way the Republican Party is going to convince the electorate is that it is not the party of big business, is for its leaders in the White House and in Congress to stop acting as if it were the party of big business.
Questioner on the right.
My name is Mike Sullivan from Glens Falls, New York. I'd like to ask a question of Mr. Harris. Concerning the poll that you just recited from the past 2 weeks, the Independent Party gaining up to 38% of the American people, could the reason for this poll be that there is no clear party choice of a candidate right now for 1976, and as polls have fluctuated in the past prior to elections at about this time, could not the independent movement just be, as the polls make it, merely an umbrella for those who are yet undecided upon which party they will support in 76, and hasn't the parties, in effect, self-destructed?
What was the last?
Have not the parties, in effect, self-destructed?
Have they not been committed suicide? There have been casualties of parties in the past, yes. Professor Schlesinger can tell you better than I the history of this, but parties are not that sacrosanct, and they've disappeared. The Whig Party, I guess, disappeared and became... And then a Republican Party was born under quite a leader, Abraham Lincoln.
So there's no such thing as we may be committed to a two-party system in the country, but what the two parties will be is not indelible in stone. I would say that this rise of independent, it is an independent party. I think that's a mistake. It's people who refuse to identify themselves with either party. That's a much better definition than to an independent party. The weakness of this stated independence is obvious. They have no organization as such. They have no channel through which to funnel their activities. The strength of it is that immediately when they get to the size that they are today, become almost like a magnet for politicians in both parties who know they've got to get this vote in order to win. I would suggest, however, that what's happening is far, far more radical than that. I think what's happening is that people, rather than saying we're independents up for grabs, now say something that will get our vote this time, people are saying, for heaven's sake, when will somebody arise in politics who's unafraid to say it the way it is, to tell us not to promise us more of anything, on the one hand, to admit that government is probably the most unpopular and least most lacking in confidence institution, to restore confidence in government, but more, to restore confidence in people. The public wants desperately to be cut in, not out. The talk you hear in Washington that distresses me most is people say, well, they're all apathetic out there. They don't care. I have rarely seen a moment in time when the public cares more, when people do care. They care desperately. We've learned enormous lessons out of Watergate, out of Vietnam, out of a whole host of traumatic experiences here. And somehow the men who speak for us in terms of political leadership, particularly the parties, talk in terms of tactics which will somehow corral votes, rather than saying, look, we have a serious crisis of governing, we have a serious crisis of survival of our society, and the key to it is not the old left-right divisions are 30 years out of date at least, maybe 40 years out of date. It's a time, really, for a whole new approach, which we get out of the people, and I don't hear out of the politicians. The voices we hear from the rank and file of people all over this country is simply not the voices you hear when you come to this city. And that's the most distressing thing.
Mr. Harris, I'd like to intervene with a question of my own. You've mentioned the politicians misreading the people on several occasions. But in a different sense, do you think the politicians are misreading the people on some social issues such as school busing, welfare payments, the size and extent of government?
I'm glad you raised that, Bob, because we've recently gone out and tested those things. Take the issue of school busing. It's my judgment it's going to be a long, long day before a politician in 1976 is going to be able to make political hay out of the issue. And do you know why? Here's the simple reason. As much as people may be opposed to forced busing for integration of schools, they just don't believe that a politician who runs for president, if elected, is going to change it. And the reason he won't change it is because they know that the law of the land requires integration between the races, and as long as that's the law of the land, no matter how much he protests, he's gonna have to enforce that law. The same thing on crime and law and order. It was supposed to be a great political issue. People are worried about their safety on the streets. Make no mistake about that. But they don't believe a politician who says, I'm a tough law and order man. I'm going to make your streets safe. Why? You know what a majority of people say about a candidate like that these days? And this is the legacy of Spiro Agnew. They say, that man is likely to be a crook. That issue has exploded right in the face of those people who thought that the American people had not a 12-year-old mentality, but an 8-year-old mentality.
Here is a question from William Broom, who asks, what will be the ideology of new parties? Are people tired of the Republican and Democratic parties trying to straddle the issues. The people want a liberal and a conservative party to get a clear choice. And there are several other questions along the same line. And just to wrap it all up in one ball of wax, I would ask, and I'm addressing this question to all three, if you could answer very briefly, is it possible that I hear a lot of Republicans who say that the Republican Party doesn't stand for anything. Is that possibly one of the reasons for the Republican decline and perhaps a more conservative Republican Party to give the voters a better choice would be its salvation? I'd like all of you to comment on whether we should have more ideological parties.
Well, I'll begin. I think that it's a question which has to be understood as one of gradations. I think a sharp ideological difference between the two parties would be a mistake for a country like the United States. Democracy is a process of compromise. It's a process of the adjustment of various interests and clashing points of view. It seems to me useful that the compromise first take place within each party and then between the parties. From that viewpoint, it seems to me that it's better to have each party to have a mixture of points of view inside it. On the other hand, if that mixture becomes so confusing that neither party appears to stand for anything, then you get extreme voter frustration. So it seems to me the ideal situation is the one we've more or less enjoyed, and that is we have a predominantly liberal Democratic Party with a conservative wing and a predominantly conservative Republican Party with a liberal wing. And I think this, has the virtue of beginning the process of compromise, which is essential to the democratic process, having it begin through the parties and then be carried within the parties and then carried on between them. I think that there often is a lot of talk by party reformers about how all the liberals should go into one party and all the conservatives into another. As I say, I think that would strain the process of compromise unduly. I think if you had a rigidly ideological Republican Party, as a party Democrat, I'd be all in favor of that. The Republicans tried that in 64, and if they weren't satisfied with that experiment, I certainly urge them to try it again in 76. But I do not think it would be, I don't think that's the direction in which the country must move. On the other hand, it must not move in the direction of party meaninglessness either. So as I say, I come out more or less where we are, a liberal party with an infusion of conservatives, a conservative party with a certain number of liberals, but each party standing for what the predominant composition of the party is and standing for it with clarity and firmness.
Conversely, I was tickled to death with the general approach of the Democratic Party in 1972. But beyond that, I was interested in that. I agree with almost every word you say. I think Mr. Harris has said that the old left-right distinctions are 30 years obsolete, and in the sense of using catchwords and ideological phrases, that's certainly true and probably reflects the same decline of semi-religious attachments in political matters that I was discussing earlier as being a cause for the decline of attachment to Democrat and Republican labels. But today, actually, what Dr. Schlesinger has described is what we have in the country today. We have two very definite and rather clear philosophies of government that have been debated and argued and fought back and forth throughout the life of our country. The one favoring more reliance, control, activity by the national government, and the other favoring less of that type of control and more reliance on individual initiative back among individuals around the country. And I think in those general terms, that's the way the parties are aligned today and will continue to be.
Mr. Harris?
I think I have to demur from both my distinguished colleagues here, and demur in this way. American people do not think in ideological terms of left or right. Only a minority of people consider themselves conservatives. Only a minority consider themselves liberals. And most people think such dialogues, sadly, are out of date, because what people are thinking of far more these days is a way to make the system work. And we're basically pragmatic as a people. And I'll give you one very radical idea, which doesn't fit either political party, and yet we find meets with vast majority agreement. Take the case of business. What should be done with business? Business has rarely been as unpopular as it is today. You talk to businessmen, and they think any time their phone rings, they get a letter, and it's postmarked Washington, it's bad news. It's got to be something negative. Business feels outside of the system, though I must say a great many Democrats charge that business is running the system. What's happened to business is symptomatic, I think, of what's happened to all institutions. Business has been hit over and over again on the head with such things as air and water pollution control, which is a societal objective. People do not want to give that up. Anyone who thinks that those issues of cleaning up the environment are gone, go out and talk to your neighbors. They can tell you that they've gone up in concern over the past 2 years, up sharply. Just water pollution up from 40 to 51%, who think it's a very serious issue. The same thing on air pollution. Another area is product safety. People are scared to death that the products they use will, if not kill them, they'll maim them, they'll burn up, they'll something disastrous will happen. Business feels it's imposed on here with its new standards of product safety. Same thing on quality of products. Same thing on employment safety, the safety for employees. Same thing for energy conservation. I could tick off a whole series of these things. Employment of minority groups, same thing. All right. What we find is what people want is to cut business into the system by not simply penalizing business. They'd like business companies to be put out of business if they can't fulfill the requirements on air and water pollution, on safety of products, on quality of products, on safety for employees, a whole host of these. But no one has ever suggested, to my knowledge, that if business goes up to these standards or beyond them, that they get rewarded by tax breaks for doing these things. And I think you're going to see in the post-Keynesian era a hooking together of these aims and objectives of society, which spell out better quality of life, to demands on the private sector, but with rewards if they do it, and big punishments if they don't. This requires governmental power, but it also means we're cutting people into the system instead of, as was tried, and people think now in retrospect it didn't work, just setting up a huge, massive program on poverty, which spent a lot of money, put a lot of programs and people and the payroll in place, and somehow didn't reach the people. But it's this kind of new approach to problems, rather than the old tired ones of more government, less government, more liberal, more conservative. This is not where the dialogue is. And what I say to the parties today is, unless they get with it, you're going to find a lot of new leaders, and I think a lot of these new freshmen in Congress are typical of this. They aren't structured traditional liberals or conservatives. They're quite radical on a lot of things, because what they say is, we've talked to the people, we know where we come from, and the old rhetoric, the old dialogue just won't wash anymore.
Mr. Harris, you're saying that you do think the parties have to become more ideological, but not in the old way.
That's right. I think our ideology is not the old liberal versus conservative. More government or less. Government, let's face it, the Republicans are right about this. Government is the single most unpopular institution in our midst. There's no doubt of that. However, government can't be removed from the scene. It's essential in many ways. But what the role of government should be, in my judgment, as I assess it from these studies, is to bring out and incorporate the participation of the best of our institutions to realize these objectives of society. No longer can we afford for everyone to go on his own bent and say, the devil take the hindmost. This is not the mood of the public. The mood of the country is to the contrary.
We've got to get together to face these problems, and they're tough problems, and there aren't any easy solutions. What we've had are politicians who say, let's come together, and then I'll pat you on the head, feed you soothing syrup, and it'll all go away in a painless way. There are no easy answers, and the politician who says that, I guarantee you, is going to get elected.
Questioner on my right.
Charlottesville, Virginia. And I would like to address this to Mr. Harris, but I think I know his answer, which, of course, is the right one, so I'll address it to the other two. Would politicians be more likely to address the real issues honestly, reduce the cant and empty promises, and begin listening to the people if the party system were abolished or quietly faded away?
I think politicians are going to start talking honestly to the people when the people show they appreciate honest talk. I think that is one of the great problems. One of the concerns we've all had is what's happened to our foreign policy over the last decade. There were many people in Congress who for a long time had private doubts about the war in Vietnam. They did not feel they dared express those doubts because they have, through long experience, learned it was much riskier politically to oppose a president on questions of foreign policy than it was to support a president on questions of foreign policy. They knew that the voters had this great longing to admire in and believe presidents and felt that people who criticize presidents, particularly in questions of foreign affairs, ought to shut up and get off his back and let him do his job, in that phrase of a couple of years back. And therefore, the politicians suppressed their doubts and then went along with this ghastly business. And I would say that, that whereas, on the one hand, I quite agree with Lou Harris, and that the people are far more discriminating and far less easily fooled than politicians and the press think. I think, on the other hand, that they do not reward courage and insight in politics in such a way as to tempt politicians to take that course. And I think all of us here in this room ought to, or listening to this broadcast, ought to examine our own consciences on the extent to which the political leaders who dared take unpopular positions have been shown that this is what, by the electorate, that this is the kind of politics we want.
I either missed the question or the answer somewhere. I thought the lady was asking whether the politicians could function without a party system.
I don't think, as I say, the question of honesty seems to be unrelated to that of a party system. Of course, politicians can function without a party system.
Issues directly and not think in terms of the party structure and ideology and so on.
Well, I think they
influenced by that.
Yeah, I think the parties may or may not, depending on the nature of the leadership of the parties, lead to better.
I just want to say you don't feel the party itself constricts them.
Are you finished? I do not think the party itself need constrict them. Sometimes it does, sometimes it gives them courage. Sometimes, if the party itself is properly addressed to the issues, it may encourage people to come along and do it. But I don't think the question of honesty is related to the question of parties. And the other part of your question, can we have politics without parties? Of course we can have politics without parties. We had politics without parties for the first half century of the Republic. And there are people to look forward, or look forward, predict political scientists, to a new period of politics without parties today. Without parties, that is, in the sense which we have them now, would be a politics of, like Chinese warlords, a politics of personal movements of the kind that Eugene McCarthy is designing for 1976 and George Wallace may be designing. I'm not sure, but as I say, I don't think the question of honesty is particularly related to the nature of party organizations. It's related to the nature of the candidate and the nature of the voter.
Mr. Obenchain, before you take a crack at that, I'm going to give you a double dip by folding in a related question addressed to you from Pat Denena of Rockville, Maryland, and of Georgetown Prep, asking, do you feel, Mr. Obenchain, that a two-party system is necessary to the American political system? After all, didn't George Washington warn against such a system? He warned against a lot of things, I guess, but... So if you could just fold that all together.
Yes, indeed. My answer to that is yes. And also my answer to the question over here is similar. I do not believe the parties are going to fade away, and I believe it would be tragic if they did. The larger independent vote that we've been talking about this morning really poses the tremendous challenge. Are the parties going to respond in ways like Mr. Harris suggests? Are we going to come up with dynamic, positive solutions to the problems of our time that hopefully build in more individual freedom and less government regulation and control? I believe that's the challenge to the party system. And between these two alternatives, a formless nine-party system and the two-party system is far preferable because it provides the channel through which the concerned individuals Mr. Harris is speaking about so eloquently can make their voices heard. It channels the opportunity of people to gather together and in effective ways present their views. And I think that's the basic challenge here. The parties are not some formless group of aristocrats off in Washington or a state capital someplace. They basically are groups of the very concerned citizens who are wrapped up in the critical problems of our time. And like this lady here, we have a Republican mass meeting in Charlottesville on the 20th of May. That's where the process of getting the political picture of this country on the track that the citizens want it to take can best be taken.
Question on the left.
My name is Elliot Schrag, and I'd like to address my question to all three gentlemen. You talk about politicians misreading the public. To what degree does the primary system, with its low turnout, contribute to this?
Professor Slazen, you want to lead off on that?
Well, I think you have to choose candidates in some way. And there, we could do it as the British do, that in effect designated candidates are designated by the central committee of the party, and then a panel is designated and a choice is made by the local party officials. You could do it through the convention system. You could do it through the primary system. None of these methods is all that infallible. I suppose that the advantage of the primary system is that if people wish to participate, they can. Access to the primary system is easier than access to the convention system or easier than the British system. So like most choices in life, it's a choice between the ideal, but between better and worse. And relatively, I can't think of a better way to go about it than the primary system. In England, I might add, there's the people who are dissatisfied with their system of choosing candidates. Party reformers there are talking about setting up something on the model of the American primary system.
I don't think the question can really be answered, but I would move to ask another question, and that is why is the younger group of voters, the newly turned 18 to 21-year-old voter, so heavily independent in the first place, and why is their participation in primaries and general elections so much lower than was predicted at the time the 18-year-old vote was created? It seems to me this is a subtopic of the very point we've been discussing this morning. And this tremendous driving interest and concern of the younger voters about the future of this country, it seemed to me it's critical that we fold that into active participation in the elections and the party system.
Mr. Harris?
I think the primary system is probably the best we have. The problem we have, I think, is something else. I think it's not, I don't think any structural vehicle is going to make the critical difference. It's what you do with the structure that you have.
We find, Arthur, exactly the same thing in England. Over 70% of the voters of both parties, the Conservatives and Labour, both think that the party leadership doesn't allow them to come into the party and participate. And that, when I saw that in London recently, I said, boy, the more you go around the world, the more it looks the same, you know. I think maybe the most significant way to answer that is a very important survey we did a little bit back was to ask people what made this country great in the last in the past, and what will make it great in the next decade or so. In the past, we found American know-how was absolutely critical, number one. Number two was our vast natural resources, and number three, our military power. We asked in the future, know-how stayed up but slipped from first to third. The other two disappeared, our vast economic power, our rich natural resources. Instead, what arose and emerged was something else. It was people's confidence that would make America great in the future would be a desire to help people here at home and to be able to get along and produce peace abroad. And this new sense of humanity, of people to people, I think, will be the keynote and the spirit of what will be a revival of politics. I have that faith for all I've said here this morning. I think it'll happen. It won't happen until you get plain-spoken, new kinds of political men, though.
Do you see anybody speaking those words today, Mr. Harris?
Well, I think the saddest thing, to put it bluntly before a group this size and their audience out there listening, is I get personally distressed at seeing just the old faces who have visibility, as they call it in politics, get support. But only for one reason, they're known. I've never seen a period, I think, where relative unknown people, if the media they can get through the clutter of the media and find a way to get them surfaced in this country, would be accepted to people quite readily if somehow they could get out from under that terrible veil of obscurity, which I think the media and the society seems to impose upon them.
Mr. Obenchain wants to intervene, and he shall have a chance to, but what you've been saying, Mr. Harris, fits right into a question that I've been relishing asking you from Joan Senadella of Norfolk, Virginia, who asks, are you the great mentioner, Mr. Harris? Are your polls structured in such a way that you make a politician a candidate? In other words, how do you decide who to put on the list of people you ask about?
Well, number one, our list has gotten up to the point of, I think it's the latest count in the Democratic Party for president in 1976, 38 candidates. On the Republican side, it's less because we have an incumbent in the White House, albeit he hasn't ever been elected, up to, I think, 14. We find out how known these people are, how familiar people are with them, and most are just not known except the old faces. Second, we find out who people choose as their first choice, second, their second choice, and then something new this year, who couldn't they vote for if you were nominated by their party? And what you find with the old faces, Governor Wallace is a good case, 39% of the Democrats say they couldn't vote for him. Governor or Vice President Rockefeller has surprised me, but 32% of all Republicans say they couldn't vote for him if you're running on the national ticket. These are high numbers. And what you get, I think, is a process both of recognition but also rejection. And I'd have to say that this may be just a blind article of faith and maybe personal hope, if I can interject that, that I think maybe 1976 never looked brighter, because it looks like the old faces and the old politics may be rejected and we may be on the threshold of something new. And that could be very exciting.
What new face are you talking about, Mr. Harris?
Well, we don't... That we're going to have to... I can't tell you, because the new face hasn't emerged.
Mr. Obenchain.
When Mr. Harris joined Dr. Schlesinger in this plea for more charisma and new faces, I felt that it was necessary for me to take a position of at least some caution in that regard. And while I certainly join in deploring the old politics, I think there's a danger in this insatiable quest that's becoming greater and greater for that new face that's going to come along next year or the next and come up with, you know, some magical forward solutions to our problem. I think, overlook old virtues when we're trying to do away with old politics. And I think there is certainly much to recommend experience, stability, moral integrity, and many things that can be found in experienced public figures as well as in young, new, charismatic figures.
Questioner on the right, please.
My name is Robin Hickey from Washington, D.C., and I would like a definition of the independent vote and how far it has reached into the two traditional parties.
Well, I thought I'd cover that at the beginning, if I might just answer directly. An independent is, we ask a simple question, regardless of how you may vote, what do you usually consider yourself as, a Republican, a Democrat, or what? And when we ask that question, we have a category. We don't use it in the phrasing independent, but you get 38% of the likely voters who say, I'm not Democrat, I'm not a Republican, I'm an independent. It means the absence of any felt affiliation with either party. They are 38% today.
I am in an unaccustomed role as a moderator, where I have to be moderate about everything. But since I do have the microphone, I would like to make a very few brief comments about the many things said today that I disagree with. First of all, I don't think the problem of the two-party system is an even street between the Democrats and the Republicans. The Democrats, for all their madness, are in vastly better shape than the Republicans. I think the Republicans are, as Senator Helms of North Carolina said, on the brink of extinction and must find a new impulse. And if they lose the 1976 election, I do believe they are in danger of going the way of the Whigs. And I believe a lot of Republicans feel the same way. Secondly, I find it very hard to ever disagree with Mr. Harris, whose track record is so excellent. But I talk to people on a much less scientific basis, and I don't find this wellspring of humanity. I find people are angry, sullen, worried, and very, very pessimistic about the future, which is why, in my opinion, George Wallace, Ronald Reagan, and perhaps in a different direction, the new independent governor of Maine, Governor Jerry Brown of California, Governor Dan Walker of Illinois, appeal to them in a very negative way with an anti-government campaign. I do believe that campaigning against government, including busing, is effective on the state and quite effective on the national level. And finally, if I can make a prediction, I would predict the chances are that in both parties in 1976, you're going to find an old face, maybe a very old face, nominated for president, and we better brace ourselves for it, because the new faces that I have been told to await ever since 1972 just aren't appearing anywhere. Now, if none of the panelists want to rebut my last remarks, I would like to thank Professor Schlesinger, Lewis Harris, and Richard Obenshain for taking part in today's meeting, and particularly those of you in the audience for attending and taking part with your questions.